Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is 1973's That'll Be the Day, a precursor to the later, more well-known sequel Stardust, starring David Essex as rebellious Jim McLean, ditching school and running away to live a life as an alienated, womanizing young man, working menial jobs and hurting those around him, all because, spoiler alert, his daddy didn't love him. But throughout all of that, he occasionally visits his very good friend, Mike, who just so happens to be played by Ringo Starr. I guess first question, Ed, about Ringo Starr and this film. It's a bold, interesting choice for Ringo to be playing this character, isn't it?
Yeah, you could say that. I think Mike is, on the surface of it, maybe not a very nice guy. He's a bit of a womanizer, or at least he makes a lot of big claims about being a womanizer. He doesn't talk about women in the most positive way. But I suppose also it's worthwhile setting this in context of 1973. The way he spoke then would not have been particularly shocking to most audiences, I think. Although, like, I do think this is probably a film that shows a bit more, it's a bit more graphic in its depictions of sex and things like that than you'd expect from the sort of thing that would be made, that would have been made a few years ago, you know. It's not Summer Holiday, for sure.
Summer Holiday's a great comparison. I think I find it hard to reconcile, like, Ringo Starr, who not that long before was known to be a part of, obviously, the biggest band ever, but, you know, be part of grandiose projects like Sgt. Pepper and, you know, Magical Mystery Tour, and the whole image that comes along with the Beatles as part of that. And this is him playing a character that yes, is a bit more gritty, but just a bit more grounded as well. Like, you know, he's really not Ringo Starr and the Beatles here. This is him really playing a very believable, sort of rebellious young man.
Yeah.
And I can't wrap my head around this happens after the entire career of the Beatles.
Yeah. But I think there's an earthiness to Ringo, and there always was. And I think that has always been part of his appeal. You know, part of the reason that everyone loves Ringo is he was sort of the Beatles' Greek chorus, in a way. He was the Tim from the office of the Beatles, in that, you know, all this mad stuff is going on around you, and all these geniuses are doing these amazing things. And Ringo, you know, as a brilliant a drummer as he is, he's not a genius and would not claim to be. And so there's always a lot of value in just having him there, because he's the guy you can relate to, you know, when, you know, he's when Tim from The Office does those little looks to camera,
yeah,
you know, he's the audience. He's the audience surrogate. Yeah. Sorry, that's a better term than Greek chorus. That. He's not really the Greek chorus, is he? Although he did go to Greece and write Octopus's Garden there. So that works. That's fine.
and the Octopus's Garden, specifically, he wrote the chorus to that song as well.
He did. You're absolutely right. That's where I was going with it. You're absolutely right. But no, he's the audience surrogate.
But what's I guess what's interesting to me is that it's not a showy role.
Yeah.
Like he's not the main character, obviously, by a long shot, but he's also not even a supporting character that's in the film all the way through.
No.
He's probably in the main meat of the film, the most, like the middle section where you really get to grips with Jim McClane, the main character, and what he's like. But you expect anyone coming off the Beatles to be playing the Jim McClane role, if he's going to go down that route of making a film like this, or to have a sort of a starrier presence in the film.
Yeah.
But he really doesn't. Like, it could be... I don't mean this is a commentary on his performance, because I think his performance is brilliant in the film, but it is a role that could be someone else playing that didn't just come off the back of being one of the most famous people in the world.
Yeah, true. But I think, you know, if you think back to the roles that one implored it, if you like, you know, so like Hard Day's Night and Help, everyone recognises that he's the best actor in the Beatles. And that's because he's the one with the sort of most naturalistic acting style. That he wasn't being starry in any of those. You could see that there was a groundedness to him. That's partly the way he acts, and it's partly your kind of understanding of his persona and how he relates to the rest of the Beatles, as I say. It makes sense. But you think of him in The Magic Christian as well. I mean, that is, you know, we spoke about the fact that that is a role that doesn't really have any narrative reason to even exist. You know, you could cut him out of the whole thing and the whole thing would still broadly work, you know. They aren't things... He's not really taking on roles that are... that rely on someone with sort of great charisma, you know. And actually, like, it, you know, that's really to his credit as well, I think. You know, he's like quite... I like the idea that there is, you know, something in him that associates much more with, you know, a fairly simple guy who works at Butlin's and, you know, and tries to get laid whenever he can. I can't see him playing Flash Gordon or something like that, you know, although that would be brilliant, that'd obviously.
Absolutely. I hear what you're saying about Ringo being sort of the standout actor of the group.
Mm.
Not to overrate the same point, but I still can't reconcile Ringo in this film with Ringo in, say, Help, which we covered relatively recently.
Mm.
It's just a completely different person on the screen.
Yeah. Like,
and I think that's probably to his credit, in that in Help, he was playing the part of a Beatle, essentially. But this, he really does feel like he's inhabiting the character that he's portraying in this film in a very realistic way.
Yeah.
And I think this is the first time I've really got a true sense of just how great an actor he was during this period. I don't get the impression I'm watching a Beatle at all in the whole film, which I know is the point, but like, you just don't expect that. In the same way that when you watch Tom Cruise in a film, you expect to always be thinking, this is Tom Cruise.
Yeah, of course.
I expect to watch a Ringo Starr film and always be thinking, I'm watching Ringo Starr right now. And I really didn't at all.
No, I agree. I think we spoke a bit in when we were talking about him in The Magic Christian, that he kind of suffered a bit through not having the other Beatles around him, not having them to bounce off, because they have such a natural rapport and shared sense of humour that without them, he, you know, sort of, it felt kind of slightly naked in a way, you know, and didn't have them to bounce off. Here, I think he really thrives in their absence. I suppose, you know, if you think in context, 1973, so this was before David Essex got stupid famous.
Yeah.
This is
the start of his sort of pop career.
Yeah. So his big hit, Rock On, isn't it? I think came out this year after this film. So 1973 is the year he took off. And so I guess 74, when Stardust comes out, that is much more of a David Essex star vehicle.
Definitely.
I think. So maybe some people, I know he'd done some West End musicals and stuff like that. But broadly speaking, this film, in terms of its cast is more being sold on Ringo than anyone else, I'm sure.
You know? Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
and as you say, like, he is, he's probably second male lead, I guess, just about, even though he's not in the whole thing. But he's certainly second on the bill, isn't he?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. He probably has just about more screen time than, of all people, Robert Lindsay.
Yeah.
who pops up as Jim's earlier childhood friend, Terry.
Yeah.
Which we can talk about later. But yeah, it took me a while to recognise him because it's so different to how we recognise the parts that he plays now.
Yeah, yeah.
But just going back to something you said earlier, so I recognise that Ringo has always had this kind of earthiness to him.
Yeah.
Do you think that... I still can't get my head around this idea that surely the kind of character he's playing this might have had some kind of shock element to it, though, when this film came out. Because this film is... It is more adult in nature because of the subject matter, or rather the tone, I guess, rather than the subject matter. And specifically the dialogue that he gets given. Like, in the first scene that he's in, he has some relatively spicy language,
shall
we say,
without
getting too much into that. And it feels like it's a... I don't want to say deliberate departure from the image that he probably would have had at this time as a Beatle.
Mm.
But he must have realised, accepting this role, that it would have felt like a departure to that image, and it was doing something quite bold to an audience, do you think?
Well, I suppose. But, I mean, but then again, it's easy to forget that, I mean... And I know you're not talking about the sort of lovable mop-top image, because that's sort of 10 years prior to this, but... I mean, even though the Beatles were sort of, you know, national treasures, I suppose, and people kind of loved them and thought highly of them, they had gone through such a public transformation over the course of their career, you know, and that thing that, who was it that someone said to the Queen? The Queen said to someone that the Beatles have gone awfully strange recently, haven't they? Back in 1967 or something like that, when they all had moustaches, you know. And so the public were very well aware of the fact that they were very, very different people, you know. And by the time, you know, you watch Get Back and sort of by the time you see the people talking in the street, you know, there. And there's a really nice mixture, you know, when they're playing the rooftop concert, there's a really nice mixture of people in the street. And some of them, there's like the old guy who's saying like, my daughter married a Beatle before. No, they've got money and they lovely bunch of lads, aren't they? Like, and there are girls there who are like, oh, is this the Beatles? Oh, yeah, I like them. Yeah, I kind of prefer Manfred Mann, you know, but they're, you know.
Yeah.
And so like they are just like in the conversation and everyone kind of has an opinion. But you really get the sense that the country has grown up with them.
Yeah, you know? I realise that I'm not accounting for a significant culture change that's happened since years to later years. I can't shake this idea that the Beatles weren't always held in the high regard that they are now, and that what comes with that is a certain level of prestige.
Yes,
but you're right. You know, I think you're probably right in the sense that the society at the time would have recognised that they have gone a little bit more rough and ready as people.
Yeah, I don't think people would have been entirely unprepared for seeing Ringo do something like this.
Would they have been unprepared for seeing his bum?
I was unprepared for seeing his bum.
Do we think it was his bum, or do we think it was a bum double?
A stunt bum.
Yeah.
I don't know, actually. I forget how it was cut. Not the bum, scene.
I rewound a few times.
Okay, good.
I looked at it several times. It definitely... looks like it could have very easily been a cutaway to a stunt bum.
Oh, I see. Okay.
There's certainly no connection between the bum and the face.
There's no
I certainly phrased that wrong.
Not necessarily a connection. Yeah, man and bum.
There's no connection between man and bum. Okay. I mean, is there ever?
Well.
But the camera doesn't pan down or pan back up again or anything like that, where it's recognisably Ringo's body that is showing the bum.
Right, okay.
But it's certainly there to titillate, right? You've got Ringo Starr in your film, and you're showing what is supposed to be, whether it is or not, what it's supposed to be. His bum, bare naked bum on film.
Yeah.
That has to have, I don't know, got the due attention, which I'm sure it was angling for.
Mm. Well, yeah. I suppose it would have been second Beatle bum ever witnessed after John and Yoko's Two Virgins cover.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever seen Paul or George's bum publicly?
Not publicly.
No, I mean, I'm sure someone's seen their bums in private.
Yeah,
And good luck to them, you know.
No, fair enough. Okay, but I did think it was an interesting conclusion. That felt a little bit gratuitous to me because it was...
Yes.
There was one rare moment in the film I feel that really tried to make hay of the fact that it had Ringo in it and was trying to do something titillating, like I say.
Yeah.
With that.
Yeah.
With the rest of the film then, now that we covered the most important part,
yeah,
goes secondary character.
Yeah.
We spoke before we started recording that I hadn't seen this film before. I'm aware of the film Stardust and the plot of that,
yeah,
which is a much more... There's a much more accessible plot summary to that film, which is man becomes famous rock star, goes off the rails. Right?
Yeah.
I was expecting this precursor to that to be a bit more about... to be very much similar to Nowhere Boy, which obviously we covered on this season.
Yeah.
John Lennon, a like character, rebellious teen, ditches school and gets involved in music and what happens in along the journey to doing that. That is not what the film is. The film is very much telling a very different story to the extent that his interest in music is barely a thing.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like it's telling the story before the story you want to see,
yes,
almost, know. I don't know if recently there's been a sort of trend in celebrity autobiographies where they release... I read John Cleese's autobiography and I listened to the audiobook of Lenny Henry's autobiography. And they both end right when the bit that you really want to know about starts, because there's going to be a sequel.
Who would do that, Mark Lewison?
Yeah, exactly. He's got a lot to answer for.
Doesn't he? Yeah, setting his trend. But this idea of celebrities presumably being contracted into some kind of like 3-book deal to tell their actual life story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're very good books and I enjoyed them. But, you know, I was thinking... Oh, right, okay, this is the bit I really want to know about. It deliberately stops right before, here's all the interesting stories about my career.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this is quite similar in that I hadn't seen this before, and so I was expecting the tale of a guy who sort of already plays guitar and is trying to make it, or trying and failing to make it, and then gets his big break towards the end of the film. Mm. But no, the end of the film is him buying his first guitar, having decided to be in a band for the first time.
Yeah, which is interesting because there's a claim made in our ever faithful research centre of IMDb trivia that states that the film was loosely based on John Lennon's early life.
Right.
There isn't much to suggest that that's true other than the fact that he was abandoned by his dad early on in the film. But what the Jim McClane character does have is this sort of poetic sensibility. Like he's writing poetry often throughout the film, but often that represents as him having like a voiceover narrative.
Yeah.
It's clearly a poem that he has written. So there's this idea that there's an artistic, sensitive, and clearly very intelligent side to that character.
Yep.
And he is a fan of rock and roll at the same time. But it just doesn't manifest in an interest in playing music.
No, not at all.
He has this sort of like, there's an artistic soul to the character. But in terms of relating it to John Lennon and or relating it to the film that Stardust eventually gives us, it doesn't necessarily feel like it's heading in that direction at any point in the film.
No, not really. And he watches rock and roll shows a fair bit throughout the film, and you know, and he obviously enjoys them, but there's only the last one he sees in the film, and the band are playing, it's one of the songs that Beatles went on to cover. Is it Slow Down? Maybe it's Slow Down. It's one of the Larry Williams ones, Slow Down or Bad Boy. No, it's Slow Down, I think. And he is noticing the women in the audience sort of going for it, and you know, and that they're all sort of like fancying the lead singer and stuff. And, you know, I suppose you're supposed to think that that's a kind of turning point for him. But I was just thinking, but you've been going to these shows for like the last 2 years or however long the narrative of this film has gone on. And that has been happening the whole time, but you're only noticing it now.
Yeah. And also, you'd expect in any of those shows for him to take an interest in the band as well. Like, it's a little bit of an empty notion, I think, for this idea to present itself at the end of the film, whereby he's only interested in playing rock music because he's realised that girls go for rock stars.
Mm.
Like, it feels like there should be a little bit more groundwork laid there in terms of him actually liking the idea of being on stage and playing the music that he likes to listen to.
Yeah, a passion for it.
None of that comes through.
No, that's true. You know, and I suppose, you know, in Nowhere Boy, you get... Well, I mean, the difference is not, like, Nowhere Boy doesn't have to work hard to make you believe that John Lennon was passionate about music, because, I mean, A, we know that already going in. But B, you know, it's all there in what he actually did. You know, it's sort of, you know, listening to Elvis in particular and those sort of early records and getting really, really inspired by it, you know. And yeah, that is not, and wanting to learn how to play guitar. And that is not what Jim does in this film.
Yeah.
You know, he's a sort of music fan who then, like, towards the end of the film, seems to have come to the conclusion that he's going to try performing for the first time.
Yeah. That this film essentially is about a young guy who, over the course of the film, decides he just wants to have more and more sex with more women.
Yeah.
That's basically the for want of a better word, thrust of the film.
Yeah.
because you know what comes from that film, what comes from that part of the film, is the idea of who he hurts along the way, and the relationship he forms, and ultimately this kind of realization that he has, and us as an audience has, which is that it all stems from this sort of abandonment that he experienced as a child.
Yeah.
But in terms of actual substance for the plot, it is basically him just getting on with more and more women.
Yeah.
Is that fair? That's
well, more or less, I suppose, you know, there's the desire, I suppose, to be free and not to be tied down. That seems to be the main thing. So, like, you see that in him right from the start, where he's just kind of fed up at school and he decides to sort of throw his school books in the river and just bunk off. This is the thing, that it kind of culminates in this thing, the whole film culminates, I mean, in his deciding to go off and be a rock and roller. But what he's done immediately before that is do the thing that his father did to him, which was to walk out just because he is bored. You know, he's just bored of being a father. He's bored of suburban life, you know. And it's an odd thing that the film does, I think, because it seems to be suggesting that is because he's availed of a sort of libertine spirit in some way, and that's something to aspire to, maybe, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think boredom is a key theme there in the film, because that's his motivator, isn't he? I think there's this idea that he is such an intellectual spirit that he's looking for new challenges, but I guess that presents itself in opportunistic ways. So, yeah. Like, he's very quick to sort of take on new jobs and sees the best of a situation. I think even at the end, when someone's asking him if he still plays harmonica, he sort of makes out as if he has more music experience than he does, in order to sort of, you know, seize that opportunity that he can see is coming.
Mm.
Because later on in the film, when he actually does settle down and get married, you get the sense that he's only doing that out of boredom, because he hasn't experienced that before. You
know, yeah, that's true.
This idea of being chased with his fiancée as well, because he doesn't want to, they don't have, like, any sort of real intimacy before the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he's doing that because it's new to him and he just wants to see what that's like.
Yeah, it's true. I suppose it's interesting. I mean, so the idea that this is based on John Lennon's life, I suppose, you can see parallels. So so the script is written by Ray Connolly, who's a Beatle author who we've seen before. It's one of the talking heads in the Sergeant Pepper documentary that we featured last season. And he's the author of, among other books, the author of a book called John Lennon, A Restless Life, which I haven't read myself, but Jim McLean appears to be living a restless life in that sense.
Yeah,
that idea that he is always looking for something new, and maybe has that kind of dilettantism that John always did, just sort of getting bored of things quick, getting quite obsessed with things and then getting bored of them quickly and discarding them.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So there do seem to be parallels between him and John. And you know, obviously the father leaving him as well is the obvious thing, but yeah.
And becoming a husband and a young dad, I guess, as well. That's clearly a parallel there as well. Yeah. Do we think that, I guess one of the things that I was surprised by the film, we mentioned earlier about how we thought the film was going to tell us a particular story and how it, you know, it subverted my expectations in that way. I actually like the film more for doing that. I'm glad that it took me somewhere unexpected and was presenting me with a different kind of character that I wasn't expecting to see in a film like this.
Mm.
I think one of the ways that it does that is that the character starts off as very sympathetic, but ultimately becomes irredeemable.
Yeah.
You know, I guess how do you feel about watching a film like that where you have a protagonist that is basically someone you don't really feel like you can root for?
Yeah, well, I mean, these days it's not that unusual, is it, to have anti-heroes at the center of things. But I hate to say it, but let's be clear, Jim in this rapes a girl.
Yeah.
And he hits a woman as well. He's gone back to her place for sex and she has a baby there which he didn't know, and he hits her and runs off. I hate to say it, but I wonder if in 1973 this would have been quite so irredeemable as character features.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Audiences would have thought very differently about sexual politics in those days.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, yeah, you know, and I don't mean it means that everyone would have been completely okay with it, but it's probably not quite the same thing.
What you do have, though, is, and I'm kind of working through this in my head as I'm saying it, but what you do have is a relatively canny piece of casting with Ringo as Mike, who then condemns that.
Yeah.
Not the hissing, but the rape.
Yeah, right?
What we know and would recognise in that film as rape, but I guess how the film presents it, it has made in 1973 as taking advantage of a young schoolgirl.
Yes.
But you have Ringo, who he's always going to have the audience on his side, acting as a voice of conscience in that moment, saying, you know, like, you went too far, basically.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, there's an audience view might be different in 1973 is now, you still have good old Ringo on the side there to tell the audience exactly what they should be thinking at that moment, and making sure that everyone is aware that if Ringo thinks it's bad, it's definitely a bad thing.
Yeah, he's a good moral barometer, isn't he?
You know, always is.
You can tell that, but I like the fact that Ringo's having sort of chiding him for what he's just done. And Jim responds by saying, "Well, you're no bloody Jesus," which is a great line.
Yes, yeah.
That kind of thing, these days, I like the fact that normally you would say something like Mother Teresa or something like that, which is someone who's supposed to be like a complete paragon of virtue.
Yeah.
He's just gone straight for Jesus.
Yeah,
just an odd line, you know.
Yeah, that's true. You going back to the scene with the young mother. Who has the baby in the room. The crying baby thing that happens in this film, did you pick up on this? It's very, I feel like it's quite overt and a bit forced and weird.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a trigger for him, right? Yeah. After, you know, the abandonment.
But it happens, it feels like it happens at every key decision in his life. So I don't know whether the first girl that he sleeps with in the movie is supposed to be him losing his virginity, but there's, you know, it's certainly similar experience in the sense of how it's portrayed in the film, right?
Okay.
He's very sort of clumsy, he seems like he doesn't know what he's doing, very quickly, etc. There was a crying baby next door there's the crying baby in that room. When he hits that woman, that feels like that's the catalyst for him then returning home, because that's what happens in the next scene, is him coming back to his mum's house. And it happens about four or five times in the film. There's a crying baby even in the foreground to their wedding, and there's a mum pulling the young child up from the floor. And it happens a lot in the film. And I feel like it's, in some ways, it's it's the way that it's used is quite naturalistic. So I would say it's used quite cleverly, but it's not subtle.
No,
like the you know, it's quite done in a very heavy-handed way, and it's done so frequently that it feels like by the end of the film, you're like, okay, I get it. Like, you know, crying babies. Yeah, this is all about him being young and losing his daddy and stuff. But I guess there's a certain amount of respect I still have for them trying to incorporate some sort of recurring motif, audio motif in the film.
Yeah, definitely, because it is. Because it's quite disjointed in that way that I think just a lot of kind of 70s cinema was when they were sort of getting out of that era of everyone having definitely been stage actors and, you know, sort of oddly short scenes. That sort of reminds me of Serpico, actually, the way that Serpico is, which may be even the same year or around about the same time, 73, 74, that kind of thing. It was very kind of disjointed in terms of the way it's lots and lots of short scenes over and over again, and also you get bits in Serpico where he just sort of turns up at the precinct and you get just from his hair and clothes and stuff that a year or two has passed, you know. And it happens in That'll Be the Day as well, where you get this thing where he's just suddenly working in Butlins, like they haven't told you that this is a job he's applied for or anything, you know. And so because you get this slightly odd staccato rhythm to things, it's quite hard to kind of feel like the character is being sort of properly established, you know. It's kind of like you're seeing like these little extracts from his life. You're not quite seeing him develop. And so I suppose the crying baby things is a sort of attempt at a through line, which, I agree. It should be commended for trying to do something like that. Yeah. But it doesn't quite pull it off.
I completely agree. Interestingly, what you're saying there about the disjointed nature of the film, I would argue that helps lend itself to this idea of him feeling quite isolated as a character.
Yeah.
I think if you understood those joins more, the character and the film itself becomes a more comfortable experience, and I don't think it's meant to be.
Yeah.
So I think there's probably some thought that goes into how that's been presented.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, what did you think of David Essex as, you know, in lead as a performance? Because I was really impressed with that. I think.
Oh yeah, it's very good. Yeah.
I think there are layers that he brings to that where he's in his quieter moments. I feel like he's actually doing some good business with the character and delivering some sort of. I think he's being sensitive to what the film is trying to say about the character at the time he delivers that well.
Yeah, I think so. But I suppose I don't know that much about David Essex, but I don't think he is a pop star turned actor. He was sort of already an actor, or at least he was a song and dance man. He was already doing West End musicals and things like that.
Sure.
So it's not quite the same thing as, oh, this is a pop star, and it turns out he's quite a good actor as well, you know. But I think his performance is very good. He's there's a lot of, you know, it could go down that sort of disaffected youth path, but actually there's a lot of that almost 70s kitchen sink element to it, where you do get a fair few scenes where not loads is happening. You know, there's a fair bit of like when he goes to whatever seaside town it is.
I don't know where it's supposed to be, but I know it was filmed in Shanklin in Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
If you've ever been to it, it's a lovely village. I've been there most years, yeah.
Oh, really?
It's really, really lovely. I was overjoyed when I read that that was where it was filmed. It was unrecognisable from as much as you think of Isle of Wight not changing much over the years, but
right.
I certainly didn't recognise it on screen. But when I found out that that's where it was filmed, like that's specifically in the Isle of Wight where I like to go because it's a really lovely vintage cottagey type part of the...
Oh, okay.
Very nice.
Yeah. They don't say where it's supposed to be, I don't think.
No,
but I presume sort of Brighton or Margate, yes, or whatever, that kind of thing. But yeah, he is kind of standing, just sort of looking out to sea, basically, you know, and you know, he's got to do a bit of, he's got to give you the impression that he is a sort of frustrated intellectual.
Yeah.
So, there's been a bit of characterization up to that point. Like, we know he's bright because, you know, the teacher catches him daydreaming and asks him a question to catch him out, and he answers it perfectly. And so we know that, like, aha, he's intelligent, but just not in the way that teachers want him to be. You know, it's a natural intelligence. It's not, you know, but there's a rebellious spirit in there too. Yeah, so we know this about him. So, yeah, he has to convey quite a lot, and he does have quite a lot of scenes where he's largely on his own, you know, and, you know, he's got to convey that just through physical business, and he does a very good job of it, I think.
It's interesting you say that, because that scene at the start with him answering that teacher's question so well, that is a moment that everyone likes to see on screen, right?
You know,
the older, more grumpy adults trying to show up someone and then getting his comeuppance kind of thing.
Mm.
So immediately in that first scene, I feel like he wins you over. But it's an interesting character arc, isn't it? Going back to what we were saying before, where he does have our sympathy. We are rooting for him at that point. But actually, the character arc is for him becoming someone that we really dislike. And, you know, again, bringing it back to what we're really here for in the Beatles, when you mentioned before about Ringo being a good moral barometer.
Mm.
He says, Ringo says something like, I thought I was a bastard, but you. The one point is great. But also, if there was ever a point where you felt that Jim McClane was irredeemable as a character, other than the time where he rapes that schoolgirl.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's that.
There's
that,
obviously. Yeah, yeah. And Ringo says, you went too far.
Mm.
It's when he sees Ringo getting beaten up and doesn't do anything to stop
him. Yeah.
His audience at that time was like, you bastard.
Yeah. And actually, yeah, you're right. Yeah, because in 1973, that would have landed much more probably as a this is a bad guy kind of thing.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So didn't help his mate in a fight.
And it really speaks of that opportunism that we spoke about earlier, where he basically saves his own skin.
Yeah.
And then immediately gets his mate's job.
Yeah.
As a result of that.
Yeah.
Like,
it's
worked out well for him.
Yeah.
It's an interesting that a film of this era, I think, it feels a very modern approach to this kind of story where you are following a character that only really goes down a sort of a dark path that you don't want it to follow, and that's where it ends.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think, Ringo actually. When you see him getting beaten up, that's the last you see of him.
Yeah.
So, like, he hasn't been killed, but he has been, we're told, like, he's been beaten up fairly badly and he won't be at work for a while. And then Jim gets his job and you never see him again. And actually, I was left feeling like he got sort of pretty short shrift, really. Like, yeah. I really wanted to see more of him. But I don't mean, you know, more than his bum, you know. But, like, you know, I wanted to see... I wanted to see more, you know, more of him, more of his performance.
More of his presence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, there's a scene where they're playing snooker and they're talking, and Ringo has this sort of monologue about being brought up in an orphanage. And so he's taking shots, or he's watching Jim take shots, and then he's taking shots himself while he's delivering all this. And I just think there is a real style to his delivery where people have always talked about he has this sort of hangdog expression that, you know, his resting face is a naturally sad one,
yeah.
You know, which is, you know, incredibly endearing. But I also think he kind of brings that to his acting where he can deliver this dialogue, and it's quite a sad story, But he's kind of delivering it in a way that there's a sort of pathos behind it, you know. Mm-hmm. A bit like a sort of Sylvester Stallone or something like that, you know. Like when Stallone first came along, there were people talking about him, you know, that first performance in Rocky is sort of Brando-esque in that, you know, the star Stallone Brando axis, you know, which is well known. You think about that, you know, those three actors. They're not terribly expressive actors, but you know, there's something going on. There is a sadness behind them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and pathos is definitely a key element of that, I think.
Yeah,
there were some moments as well where, because of that, I think because of how he, because of what his screen presence is like, particularly because of this sort of hang-up-like expression that you say, I always expect him to be able to do that quite well on those scenes. I think his delivery of that monologue while they're playing ball is particularly brilliant.
Mm.
But him being able to sort of have those puppy dog eyes and bring this out, this is a good. I actually really enjoyed seeing him a bit more swagger in this film.
Yeah.
there's a great moment where he picks up two girls at the room playing mini golf and deliberately hits his golf ball towards them and then like does this like faux thing that's just to himself where he's like, oh darn. You know, and then swaggers over. And then they'd be like, you know, can you jive? And he's like, can we jive? And he does a little twist and stuff. And it's just this idea of him being like a bold, cocky young fella at that point. It's really endearing to see.
Yeah. There's a lovely, there's always a lovely kind of style to his acting. I like, you know, the swagger thing is nice. I know exactly what you mean. There's a bit in Hard Day's Night where I think the rest of them are sort of ragging on him about whatever it is. And John goes, temper, temper. And Ringo goes, well, like that. but he interrupts him as well. Like, so they're not just speaking lines to each other. Like he's already understands acting well enough to know that people interrupt each other and talk over each other a bit. And he's,
that's interesting.
And he's doing that, you know, and he's kind of always had that element to him. But yeah, no, you're right. It's nice to see a different side of him. You know, there's a bit where, like, isn't he like, he's dancing with the girl and then they go and sit down. They're like, they lose the, it's one of those dance competitions where you get voted off until the last dancer's standing, you know, and they get voted off and they have to go and sit down. And she says, oh, I thought you said you could dance like that. And like, what does he say to her? It's like,
I remember when they sit down. And she asks for a drink and she says, and a packet of crisps. And he like walks off muttering to himself, going, God, what's the world?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
But yeah, like, I mean, yeah, it's a really, really impressive performance, I think, by Ringo in this film. I think that going into this, I knew that this was a film that was generally regarded as being featuring one of his better performances in his acting career. But I really wasn't prepared for this from him. I think it was it's really just a particularly naturalistic performance from him that I just didn't realise he was capable of, honestly.
Because if you think about the thing about his acting career is like I'm aware that he did all these films in the 70s, Ringo, and I've seen very few of them, you know, but, you know, obviously because of this, we're going to end up watching all of them sooner or later.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'd be a dereliction of duty not to, you know. but this is the thing, but it kind of makes me realize that actually I don't really know a lot about his life post-Beatles. I'm aware of the broad strokes that he, the alcoholism and then eventually meeting Barbara, and sort of cleaning himself up and getting, you know, and getting healthy, you know. But other than that, you know, it just makes me think that the thing that Beatles cinema, the thing that Beatles film and TV is really missing is a good, well-made Ringo documentary. I'd be really fascinated to see that.
Like the Scorsese's Harrison documentary.
Yeah.
Similar kind of thing to that.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because like I say, I mean, you know, the thing I was talking about with him being the sort of Beatles audience surrogate is like, I think he's a really significant figure in that sense. It's such a fascinating thing to have a man who, you know, he's unfairly maligned as untalented, which is ridiculous, ridiculous. But the idea of, you know, everyone in the Beatles, the other three Beatles speak of him so highly. And it's not out of sympathy because they want, you know, that, you know, because it's like, oh, we don't want to say anything bad about Ringo, but you know, he just sits in the corner kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
They all absolutely loved him, and the spirit and the kind of like social cohesion he brought to that group is like not to be underestimated at all. And the whole thing would not have happened without him, you know. And I don't mean not just in the same way. I mean, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
I think that is a really interesting figure. You know, we've spoken before about ways to do stories about slight kind of outsider figures. You know, we're talking about how to do the Pete Best story as the kind of nearly man story, you know.
Yeah.
And Ringo being a figure who, someone who was generally seen as being sort of quite closely attached to something magnificent. And I think people would probably mistakenly think that he didn't participate much in it. Mm. And I think that's a part of his story that should be told and told well, you know.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think, you know, I'm going to force myself to stop making the point that I make on most of these podcasts about how if you're going to do a biopic, it needs to be story-led first. So there needs to be a point to the biopic and for there to be some kind of conflict and resolution, which is why the Pete Best conversation we had on an earlier episode makes sense, because there is a natural conclusion that reaches.
Yeah.
And an interesting, and he, because of how close he came to being the Beatles, that in of itself is an interesting story to tell.
Yeah.
I can see how Ringo has one as well, as being any way we talk about this, it sounds like we're doing him a disservice.
Yeah.
I don't want to say that he's a spectator in the band, but you know what I mean by him not... He was the only one of the four that isn't regarded as a genius songwriter.
Right, yeah.
Right? So in that respect, he was there in a room with these three songwriters and working with them and being the heart of the band that we know he was.
Yeah.
And that in itself is an interesting story. He's like the everyman way in, gateway into what it would have been like for... As enormously talented as he was, for anyone who wasn't like a genius songwriter level person to be in the same room as that while that was all happening.
No, he's a relatable figure, isn't he? You know, he's your way in to sort of to thinking to yourself like, you know, oh, I could have been in this band. You know,
and he's just so likable with it as well.
Like,
to the extent that where you could easily assume that the Beatles could have been a band John Lennon, Paul McCartney and George Harrison could have been in a band together where if it wasn't for Ringo Starr, they would have cycled through many drummers.
Yeah.
Because those drummers would have got frustrated at not being on the same level as them. But Ringo never felt particularly resentful about his position in the band.
No, and I think other drummers would have thought of themselves as like, well, you know, I'm just a sideman here.
Yes.
And I've got to back these guys up, but nobody's really interested in anything I've got to say. Whereas a big part of, particularly when their initial fame and particularly when they broke America, is Ringo plays such a key part in those early press conferences. Yeah. You know, that first one at the airport when they get to New York, that press conference, it's mainly based around him, you know. He's the main sort of comedian. It is a comedy turn that is being done there. Yeah. They are doing a group stand up comedy routine essentially, and he's leading it, you know. And it is a big part of everyone falling in love with them, you know.
Yeah, and because he's so relatable and such a nice sort of figure in that story of the Beatles. And, you know, we talk about this quite often, but that moment in Get Back where he just basically offhandedly comments that he'd quite happily sit and watch Paul McCartney play piano for hours is just a really nice moment. I really love that.
Yeah.
Because he genuinely means it. He's got such respect and love for his fellow band members.
Yeah.
But you're right, like an actual documentary that would do a deep dive into his life as a Beatle and then what happens to him and his career and his choices post the breakup
would
be really fascinating to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I just think like there's such a lovely scene that where he says that about Paul, you know, oh, I could watch him all day or whatever.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're doing as well. Like we have watched Paul McCartney play the piano for like the last 8 hours, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, and we feel the same way. You know, it's like, oh, I could just watch him do this all day. You know, and so that's what I mean. It's like he's your way in. He is the guy in the room who thinks the same way you do. And you know, he's just all the more relatable and all the more lovable for that, you know. And I think, yeah, just a really interesting figure who I think would be well served by a good, well-made documentary.
Or even feature film. Forget the John Lennon approach, which we've tackled a few times already.
Yeah.
Do a biopic of the Beatles where Ringo is the star of that film.
Yeah.
To watch that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Shall we talk about, there aren't many, I don't think, unless you have surprises for me, but shall we talk about other Beatles connections that this film has?
Sure.
So there is one in particular I wanted to call out straight away because I don't really know the full extent of the connection, but it's worth pointing out, I think, that the film is supposedly based on a song by Harry Nilsson called 1941, where the lyrics are about a dad who leaves a boy in the first verse, and the next verses are about him joining a circus and meeting women and then settling down. And the last verse is him leaving his own young son, and this idea of this cyclical nature of life. Apparently the film is based on that song. Obviously they swap out circus for affair.
Mm-hmm.
But Harry Nilsson obviously has connections to the Beatles, right? He became a friend of John Lennon later on after the Beatles.
Yeah, that's right. A sort of arguable, one of the people who has a claim to the title Fifth Beatle. That was sometimes...
Wow, there's so many.
Yeah. Sometimes
it's our turn.
Yeah, we've got to be on the list somewhere, surely. Me first, obviously. He was sometimes described as the American Beatle, I think. So he was one of the crowd that were known as Hollywood vampires who... Lennon was hanging out with during the Lost Weekend in Los Angeles. So it's him and Nilsson, Ringo, Keith Moon, who's also in this film.
Of course, I'm talking about Keith, yeah.
And Alice Cooper, probably some other people as well. So they were just a sort of big drinking crowd. John produced one of Nilsson's albums.
Great.
Yeah, so I think that's broadly the connection. So yeah, I'm not sure how much Ray Connolly based the script on that song, but yeah, I mean the parallels are obvious, you know?
Yeah, I feel like it was a mandate for the script, you know, to create a spec script based on the story that Harry Nilsson sings in that song, rather than it being sort of like a direct influence in that way. It's almost like, oh, this is good enough to be a film. Someone write that script,
right? Yeah,
and then Ray Connolly comes along and presumably then at that point starts basing some elements on John Lennon.
Yeah.
Interesting though, isn't it? I do like these kind of like mini connections that we find in these things. So Harry Nilsson, John Lennon and Ringo Starr used to hang out as part of the Hollywood Vampires crowd.
Yep.
And that also featured Keith Moon, who is also in this film.
Yep. And Robert Lindsay. No, not Robert Lindsay. That would have been good though.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
But Keith Moon is in it, and you know, he's barely in it. He's in the same band as a young Billy Fury.
Yep.
Rory in the Storm?
Rory Storm and the Hurricanes.
Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, that was it, there we go.
Yeah. They seem to be, because he's sort of blonde as Rory Storm was, and he seemed to be basing that band on that. Because also, like, Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, Ringo played with them in Butlins a lot.
Of course.
You know, so that was their main thing.
I know, I completely missed that entire connection, of course.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
So that thing where, when they wanted Ringo to come and join, come and join the Beatles after they got rid of Pete Best. That odd line that he says in the anthology, which he puts loads of stress on, he says, you know, and I said to them, like, well, I can't join you now. Like, I've got a gig, you know. I'll join you Saturday. It's like, right, okay. So you mean three days after they ask you? Okay,
yeah.
You know, it's not that dramatic, you know. But that gig he's talking about is a Butlins residency that he had with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes.
Oh, wow, yeah. Amazing. Okay, that's interesting. I had no idea about that. And, I even failed to make the Rory Storm connection. So it's also brilliant. You then have Keith Moon presumably playing the Ringo Starr part.
Mm. Yeah.
He does a lovely bit of business on the drums as well.
Yeah.
He really goes hard on them.
Yeah.
It's quite fun to see.
Yeah.
But, so you do have surprises for me with the Beatles connections. I only had one more.
Right.
which is in the early diner scene. There's a song playing on the jukebox.
Yep.
Did you hear that? Did you recognise that? You did, didn't you?
Raunchy.
Yes, yes.
It's of George auditioning on the bus fame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm annoyed. I thought I was going to get that. There were actually more clear Beatles references than I obviously come to realise.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're forgetting the main one, but it doesn't need to be said that That Will Be the Day is obviously a song that the Beatles themselves covered.
Yeah.
Or rather, Quarrymen covered as well, initially.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, so all in all, a film that definitely is worthy of inclusion on this list of films that we talked about on this podcast.
Yeah, I think we've justified it at least, you know, like exactly, which yeah. is, you know, more than we've done the previous ones.
You bring everything in, it wasn't enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have anything else to mention or talk about? That Will Be the Day?
No, I think that'll be all.
Hey,
I was pleased with that.
Yeah, I bet you were.
Yeah, yeah.
Well done.
yeah, all right.
If you have watched That'll Be the Day and want to share your views on it, please get in touch with us on all the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. You can tell us what you thought of Ringo Starr's performance, what you think of the film generally, or what you think of Ed's comment just there saying that'll be all. Otherwise, if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast or any of our other episodes, please feel free to write us a review. We don't have enough reviews. Say nice things about us. It'll be much appreciated. Thank you. Otherwise, we will catch you again for another episode next week. See you then. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.